ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Anthony Burke here, host of By Design on ABC Radio National, a show about the clever ideas and human stories behind the spaces, systems, and objects shaping everyday life. Whether you're curious about architecture, interior design, fashion, or anything in between, we reveal why design matters in a rapidly changing world. By Design on ABC Listen.
For the first time in more than half a century, astronauts will soon be heading back to the moon.
The rocket that will be used for the first crewed mission to the moon in more than 50 years is beginning its journey to the launch pad.
Artemis II will carry four astronauts farther from Earth than any human has ever traveled.
As early as next month, NASA plans to send humans around the moon for the first time in 50 years.
There's a fair amount of excitement about the launch coming up. And here in Florida, there's a lot of publicity locally. The real space geeks are making plans to try and come down for launch. And I always tell them, well, you know what? Make sure you buy a refundable or flexible ticket, because launch scrubs happen and they will break your heart.
And the Artemis II mission has had its problems.
At the Kennedy Space Center overnight, a temporary blow to NASA's planned mission to send four astronauts on a trip around the moon. That technical issue forcing NASA now to delay its February launch.
The earliest the Artemis II mission could have launched was on a handful of dates in early February.
And this window was missed.
I don't think that anybody was terribly surprised that they scrubbed the remainder of the test and immediately said, yeah, it's not going to be this time.
So now NASA is looking at March.
If we're lucky. I think, they learned enough lessons from Challenger and from Columbia and from Apollo 1 back in the 60s that you don't fool around with this stuff. The last thing you want is something bad to happen with humans on board.
But not everyone is convinced that Artemis II is safe.
We should have never had Columbia. We should have never had Challenger. And I'm afraid to say, if we fly Artemis II with the crew, we're playing Russian roulette.
NASA management says otherwise.
We've done the work, the analysis, and the testing to show that we're in good shape for the mission.
Despite these reassurances, some remain concerned.
These astronauts coming back from the moon are going to be going faster than any other humans have ever gone, at some 25,000 miles per hour, and there is no room for error.
We have to stop this. Recognize how badly NASA is broken, because it's not going to be easy to fix. We're in big trouble right now.
On the series so far, we've taken you through the Challenger and Columbia disasters, how and why they happened, and what we learned for next time.
Except now it is next time. It's here. Artemis II is set to launch imminently. So for the final episode of this series, we're going right to the present day to look at the upcoming mission. What it is, why it's happening, and what the risks are.
This is The Challenger Legacy, a five-part series of science fiction for ABC Radio National. Episode 5, Apollo on Steroids.
The directive I'm signing today will refocus America's space program. It marks an important step in returning American astronauts to the moon. This time, we will not only plant our flag and leave our footprint, we will establish a foundation for an eventual mission to Mars, and perhaps someday to many worlds beyond.
Okay, so we're on the cusp of Artemis II, but clearly flying astronauts around the moon is not the end game.
You see, the Artemis project is apparently all about establishing a human presence on the moon, building a space base that can then be used to support humans going to Mars.
And why is it that the moon is suitable for this base?
Because it has water, but in the form of ice.
Right.
Ultimately, I think the idea is to create a working laboratory where people are living and working for long periods on the moon, much like we've done with the International Space Station, but just doing it there.
That's Professor Wendy Whitman Cobb. She's a space policy expert.
If we want to go to Mars, we need to figure out how to live someplace else other than Earth. And it's probably better to do that 3 days away from home than potentially 6 months away from home.
And NASA is not unique in its ambitions to get to the moon and then onto Mars.
A lot of people will argue that we're in a space race with China. In that argument, China has replaced the Soviet Union as sort of this main geopolitical driver of what it is that we're doing. And space, since Sputnik was launched in 1957, has been a theater for geopolitical competition. And even with the rise of commercial space companies, that remains the case. We can argue whether a space race today is real or not. I would say we won in 1969. Like, how do you rerun a race that was already done? But obviously, you know, it is a different era. So maybe you make the argument that this, you know, this isn't the Soviet Union. We have to run this race with a whole different country.
Okay, interesting. But for now, NASA needs to successfully launch the Artemis II mission and then fly around the moon and then come back home safely.
Yes, exactly. And the spacecraft that's going to do that is called Orion.
Orion is basically a throwback design to the Apollo days, so it's more similar to Apollo than anything else.
That's Peter King, a Florida-based correspondent with CBS News Radio who's been covering space since the mid-90s, from the Space Shuttle program right up to the Artemis project.
I'm going to dig out a very old quote from the then NASA administrator, Michael Griffin. He used to call it, when they first revealed the design, Apollo on steroids, because it would be much more powerful, a bit more roomy than the Apollo capsule. It would have more capability. And of course, keep in mind that Apollo was 60s technology and Orion will have 21st century technology. But Apollo on steroids was something that really caught on, and not necessarily in a favorable way, but I think it kind of fits.
Yes, but are they kidding themselves? Because the phrase Apollo on steroids implies that Artemis is so much better. And the question is it?
Because the setup is similar to the Apollo missions, isn't it? There's, you know, a really big rocket with a little spacecraft on top, that's Orion, which is where the astronauts will spend all of their time.
Yes, and there are actually a lot of similarities to the Space Shuttle program as well as the Apollo. So the big rocket in the middle, in on the Artemis, has two solid rocket boosters on either side, just like the Space Shuttle ones, but a bit bigger. And the main engines, sitting at the bottom of the central rocket, they are actual Space Shuttle engines. So altogether, there are a lot of components that date back to the Shuttle era, including some that have already been to space and back multiple times.
It's curious to me as to why they are using such old tech, but I suppose it's available and it works. The other thing is that unlike the space shuttles, almost none of the components are getting reused.
And that makes each launch incredibly expensive, like in the order of $4 billion per mission. And if they had to develop brand new engines, I don't know, $5 billion, $6
billion? Wow, it's astronomical. So the first test flight was Artemis 1, and that was launched back in November 2022.
Now, to the splashdown of NASA's Orion moon capsule, after a 1.4 million mile journey to circle the moon, the space agency says the return to Earth was close to perfect. Our space expert, Jim.
So, Artemis 1 went all the way around the moon and back again, but it took only dummies, not actual astronauts. They did have all kinds of sensors on them to measure radiation levels and the like to test if everything would be okay for real humans sitting in the same seats.
And did you know those dummies were actually called moonikins?
No, but wow, I love a good pun. Moonikins, mannequins. Oh my God, that's so clever.
Isn't it? So anyway, this time the moonikins are staying safely on Earth because Artemis 2 will have four humans on board. And this will be the first time astronauts will go to space in the Orion capsule.
It's a really good crew with three NASA astronauts and one astronaut from the Canadian Space Agency. Reid Weissman is the commander. He spent about 6 months aboard the International Space Station in 2014. His pilot is Victor Glover. He flew the first operational crew on a SpaceX Dragon earlier this decade. He will be the pilot. Christina Cook, who spent 328 days in space on the space station back in 2019, she will be aboard, as will Jeremy Henson, who is the rookie from the Canadian Space Agency. They've been training for this for 2.5, 3 years or so, and they're ready to fly.
Okay, so now NASA has identified three potential launch windows for the Artemis II, the first window being in February, followed by March, and then April.
But that early February launch was missed because of problems that had popped up in this wet dress rehearsal.
The reason they call it a wet dress rehearsal is because they fill the rocket with fuel. 750,000 gallons, I believe, is the number. And they fill it with fuel because they want to simulate, you know, all the launch conditions. Now, the crew is not aboard for this, but that's why they call it wet dress. It's all fueled up and presumably ready to go. Nobody hits the launch button. The sequencer stops at 33 seconds, and they unload the fuel, and if the test goes well, they set a launch date.
NASA has pushed back the launch of Artemis II until at least March. A rehearsal of the pre-launch process found that liquid hydrogen being loaded into the rocket was leaking.
And this isn't a new problem.
The biggest issue is something that plagued them during Artemis I, during the four wet dress rehearsals they had for Artemis I back in 2022. And that delayed that flight, from September to November that year. In fact, they had to roll back the rocket three times to the vehicle assembly building to fix the problem that came up this time.
So, Carl, a hydrogen leak doesn't sound good.
Well, hydrogen by itself is fine, but if you have oxygen around, which is in the air, and you give it a spark, then you can have a very big explosion. Very, very nasty.
So this problem has been around since Artemis 1. Why is it so difficult to fix, and how serious do you think it is?
Why is it so difficult to fix? Well, firstly, hydrogen molecules are very small, so they can leak through anything. Secondly, to make it liquid hydrogen, to compress it, you need to take it to only a few degrees above absolute zero. And when you start pumping, the temperature in the whole system is at room temperature, and it'll seal. And you gradually bring the temperature down to minus 50, minus 100, minus 150. And at some stage, it'll start to leak, because you haven't run it at that temperature before. And in fact, with regard to space shuttles in the past being cancelled, which happened, half of them were cancelled because of hydrogen leaks. It's a diabolical problem to deal with. But on the other hand, it's very light, and so it's got a lot of bounce per ounce, as they say, so they want to keep using it.
Okay.
So it's a persistent problem. It's plagued the whole program, and it has led to multiple delays in the Artemis 1 launch.
Now, the hydrogen leak isn't the only issue plaguing the Artemis mission.
The Orion spacecraft sustained damage during the Artemis 1 mission. If the problem happens again, it could lead to the loss of a future crew. That's according to a report released by NASA this week.
News 19's Kayla Smith.
So I basically was just sat back, was enjoying retirement. And then I heard a clip on TV. The manager of the Orion program said Artemis 1 came back from space. They saw slightly different ablation, but there was plenty of margin. I knew right then and there it didn't sound right.
NASA's Office of Inspector General tells us engineers have found more than 100 places where the heat shield cracked and broke off the Orion spacecraft during reentry.
They had 100 large craters in this heat shield. It's not supposed to do that. That was a structural failure.
So that's Charlie Kamada. Now, for two decades, he worked as a research engineer at NASA. He was an astronaut who flew on the return to flight mission after Columbia. He was the director of engineering and a senior advisor for innovation and engineering development. And when he saw those reports in 2024,
I immediately started pinging the director, the chief engineer, the administrator, the chief engineer at NASA, saying we need to build external teams like we did for Columbia to solve this problem, because we cannot solve it in-house. This was 3 years ago. 3 years later, they're still struggling trying to understand the cause of this problem.
So as we've learned from the series, The heat shield is particularly important on re-entry.
Exactly. So the space shuttles, they had thousands of lightweight silica tiles to protect the belly of the vehicle from extreme heat. However, the base of the Orion capsule is instead covered with blocks of a material called Avcoat.
You have a plasma in front of you that's over 5,000 degrees, and that's convectively heating and radiatively heating the bottom of that vehicle. Now, when you have a space capsule, that circular disc on the bottom of that space capsule has a heat shield. And what Apollo used and what we use, because the heating is much higher coming back from the moon, and it's much higher because it's a smaller radius than the belly of the space shuttle. So the heating is much higher. They have to use an ablative material.
An ablative material is a material that burns, it chars, and then the actual molecules leave the body of that material and turn to a gas and outgas. They leave. And so that outgassing helps to block some of the heat coming in. You're basically using up some of the material of the heat shield.
And how fast you burn and use up that material becomes really, really important.
The heat shield on the belly of the vehicle ranges from about 1 to 2 inches, right? And that has to absorb all that heat and protect that structure. When you start losing large chunks, if you lose them early in the entry trajectory, you basically burn up the material underneath. You burn a hole in the composite structure, the structure of the vehicle, and you disintegrate the capsule, much like the hole that was in the wing of the space shuttle. Once you have a hole and flow goes in that hole, it's superheated, it's enhanced heating, and things happen very quickly. Bad things happen very quickly.
And when Charlie says bad things happen, I've got to say Columbia springs to mind, because as we've learned, heat shields can be a matter of life and death.
So Artemis II does have a fresh heat shield, but it has the same design as the one that came back on Artemis I and that was unexpectedly damaged.
Yeah, and Charlie's not the only one asking questions. This is from a press conference held just before the most recent wet dress rehearsal.
I'm curious, do you expect the heat shield to play a big role in flight readiness review or this risk assessment?
Here's Jeff Radigan. He's Artemis II lead flight director.
Through the testing that we've done after Artemis I and the work that we've done here on the ground, we understand the limitations of the heat shield on Artemis II, and it's incumbent upon us to fly within those limitations.
Okay, so although 3 years have passed since the first Artemis mission, NASA concedes there are existing limitations to the heat shield on Orion.
Yes, or in other words, this is a known problem, and in this series, the two words known problem are something that you and I have unfortunately become rather familiar with.
Yes, we have. Now, NASA has been criticised for a lack of transparency over this heat shield issue. The report that they commissioned investigating the problem was released in May 2024. Now, that's a full year and a half after the return of the Artemis 1 mission. There has been intense heat testing on the ground, but Artemis II will be the first time that the Orion spacecraft has been flown since the heat shield issues emerged on the first Artemis flight. But NASA has implemented some changes.
We've changed the entry profile so that we're flying a profile that the heat shield can handle. And we're also ensuring that we launch on a day where the demands of the heat shield are lower.
In Charlie Kamada's mind, these workarounds are far from satisfactory.
And so you really can't change the trajectory all that much. You could come in hotter and you could come in faster, but you're still going to be losing large chunks of material.
And there's no two ways about it. It has to come back through this extremely hot plasma.
Absolutely. There's no way. There's only so much you could do, and they are going to be losing chunks of ablator. And what they don't know is it going to be a large enough chunk, deep enough chunk, early in the entry trajectory, and you will get burned through.
Okay, so instead of relying upon changing the reentry profile, what is Charlie's suggestion?
Well, he argues that NASA needs to do more work to understand the root cause of the heat shield cracking.
This is a design flaw. Fiona. You don't fix this by going to an operational workaround, like changing the trajectory or only flying above 31 degrees. The real flaw in this is the heat shield. It's got a major inherent problem. It's not a material problem. It's a structural problem. But if you don't know the physics of the problem, you cannot be assured that that workaround will work because you don't understand the mechanism that's causing the failure.
What would you say to someone who said, all right, Charlie, you retired from NASA close to a decade ago. You're not in the weeds of this. How can you be such an authority on this issue when you aren't in the room?
I came from a research culture. I became an astronaut in operating hardware. I went into senior management. The only way we solved those problems after Columbia was reaching out to the three research centers. That was the only way. We learned more about the mistakes that were being made on the space shuttle during those 2.5 years for return to flight.
What's the extent of your concern? Are you worried that Artemis Mission 2 could go the same way as Challenger or Columbia?
Yes, absolutely. We're playing Russian roulette. And that's what we did during the shuttle program. We normalized the deviance. We kept flying until it wasn't safe, right? We never fixed the problem. This was only one flight test, and it was a failure. From a heat shield standpoint, that was a failure. They claimed success. This should have never happened. We should definitely not be flying a crew on this vehicle. I lost 3 classmates and 7 friends on Columbia. And when I went back to Johnson Space Center, I saw these people that were still arrogant, thinking that they did nothing wrong. Instead of being contrite and feeling bad, they were arrogant, they were outspoken, they didn't learn, and we haven't learned our lesson.
Now, NASA was contacted for comment, but they didn't respond by this episode's deadline.
For the meantime, NASA's administrator, Jared Isaacman, and the 4 astronauts who will actually fly on the Artemis II mission, they have reviewed the data, and they say they are confident that the issues with the heat shield have been addressed. As far as the astronauts are concerned, they're ready to fly.
Carl, I've got to say, it's the engineers that have left the greatest impression on me while making this series.
Mate, I love engineers. What you see is what you get. They have this sheer determination to figure out why something is not working as it should.
We've talked a lot about the legacy of the Challenger disaster for NASA and for the present and future of space exploration, like the Artemis program. But before we finish up, I'd also like to come back to a different legacy. The impact on people, like those engineers whose lives were reshaped entirely by those events 40 years ago.
Fee, that is such an interesting perspective. So, sure, on one hand, with regard to the astronauts, the deaths were totally avoidable. But what about the ones who stayed behind? The astronauts' families, the engineers. Their stories have been so haunting and have affected me so much.
Now, Carl, before we finish up, I want to share this beautiful story that I came across while researching this series.
The morning of January 28th, 2016, which was the 30th anniversary, I called up my editor and I said, you know, I did this story 30 years ago with a Challenger engineer who tried to stop the launch, Bob Ebling, and I was thinking about calling him up today, see maybe if he's willing to go on the record.
That's NPR journalist Howard Berkus. He's the reporter we heard from in episode 2 who spoke with Morton Thiokol engineer Bob Ebling a couple of weeks after the Challenger disaster.
There was silence for a moment. My editor said, get up there, you know. And, you know, I called Bob and he was willing to talk to me. And he was in hospice care. He had cancer. He was in and out of lucidity. He not only had a walker, but he had like these parallel bars that enabled him to walk from the kitchen to the living room, the same kitchen we had talked in 30 years before. I had a sense that maybe at an advanced age, that maybe, you know, he had changed and I was right, that he was willing to talk about it.
Because unlike 1986, for this interview, Bob was willing to go on the record. But one thing remained the same. He still felt incredibly guilty.
He felt that he could have said something more convincing to NASA and to the other, because he was there in that meeting. I mean, he also spoke. He felt that he could have said something more convincing. He could have marshaled the data in some more convincing way than he had. And that the fact that he hadn't, the fact that Challenger launched anyway, meant that he was a failure. That's how he felt for 30 years.
And this is what he told Howard during that conversation.
And I think that was one of the mistakes that God made. He shouldn't have picked me for that job. I don't know. But next time I talk to him, I'm going to ask him, why me? You picked a loser.
And Leslie Ebling, Bob's daughter, can speak to the impact that this disaster had on her dad's life.
I had a brother that committed suicide, and that literally devastated my parents, all of us. And I think he was just as sad when the shuttle blew up as when my brother died. I really do.
But then something shifted for Bob after that interview aired on NPR on the 30th anniversary.
And he got letters from all over the world, and even people at NASA sent him letters to tell him that he had done the best he could do. And since he was forgiven, he forgave himself. And then he died. 3 weeks later, he was gone. And he looked so worn out, you know, and I know that it was something that hung over his head for all those years. So he was just kind of like hanging on because he felt so responsible.
And Brian Russell, another one of our Morton Thiokol engineers, recently had a similar experience when the daughter of Challenger pilot Mike Smith got in contact with him.
She reached out to me and told me that I should separate the guilt from me. And I wrote her back and I said, I'm grateful to you, the grace that she's offered me. She lost her dad for 40 years now. And I just have the pain in my heart, but I'm still around. I still have a family. But we both agreed that when something like this happens, that we live the best we can after that in our relationships with people, in our integrity and how we do our work, that we do the very best we can in everything we're involved with. She has done that, and she has a lovely family herself, and I rejoice in that. But her reaching out to me and offering that grace and forgiveness has meant a lot to me. And I love her for it.
That was the final episode of The Challenger Legacy.
Science Friction, The Challenger Legacy was made for ABC Radio National on the lands of the Gadigal and Meenang Noongar people. It's reported and presented by me, Fiona Pepper.
And with me, Carl Kruschelinski. And I should point out that Fiona did such a deep dive and I found out so much stuff I didn't know. Fiona, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Carl.
Now, the show's senior producer is James Bullen and our sound engineer is Simon Branthwaite. The series producer is Jonathan Webb and the executive producer is Patria Ladgrove.
Oh, and before you go, we'll be doing a special bonus episode of The Challenger Legacy, taking your questions for Dr. Carl and me to answer.
It'll come out 1 week after this episode, and we want to answer as many of your questions as possible. So if you do have one about Challenger, Columbia, the Space Shuttle Program, the Artemis mission, or the science of space exploration in general, send it in.
You can reach us by emailing sciencefriction@abc.net.au or via the ABC Radio National homepage. Catch you then.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.